Hello, my name is Chip Ling, and you're listening to Total EM. We are back with IPv educators for another section. This time, we're going to be breaking this up into multiple parts, and I have with me, once again, Katie Thompson. And Katie, if you don't mind, let's, before we dive into the actual topic, if you could introduce yourself again.
Sure. So my name is Katie Thompson. I am a proud physician assistant. I work in the urgent care, and I'm also a forensic examiner. So I deal predominantly with victims of interpersonal violence, domestic violence, sexual assault, child abuse of all types. Run IPV Educators, which is a small LLC dedicated to improving the education and empowerment of healthcare providers on the subjects of interpersonal violence.
Well, great, Katie. So thank you for doing that. And actually, we're using your skills with the forensic interviewing and just your experience in general to talk a little more about interpersonal violence. And this time, we're directing it towards pediatrics. So basically, for the next few sections, we're going to talk a lot about pediatric patients, the special needs, the special issues that arise. And as we were preparing for this, trying to figure out exactly what we want to do, I think we agreed that this is something that, yes, some of these elements you can apply to older patients, adults, the elderly, so on, but we really wanted to focus in on kids specifically because it definitely is worth dedicating the time. And the first part of what we wanted to talk about specifically was about some dogma that exists. And so dogma is one of those things that, you know, it's considered a foundational part. It's considered to always be true. But there are definitely things that are listed as dogma that we find out is not necessarily true. You know, the kind of one of the classic examples is the use of epinephrine to digits. So when we do digital blocks, you know, it used to be that we could never use digital blocks that contained epinephrine. And then we found out over time with research that that's not so true. So we call that process dogmalysis. And I think we're going to talk about some of the dogma that exists with history and physical, especially for abuse overall with pediatric patients. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think that sounds great. I think there's a overall, like kind of like what we were talking about when we were brainstorming this, there's a lot of fear and myths and information about pediatrics that can be kind of clarified pretty easily and make these populations like a lot less frightening and challenging to deal with.
All right, perfect. So let's go ahead and let's talk about some of these. Now, what are some of the big pieces of dogma, especially ones that are not accurate, that you'd say we see the most and frustrates you?
Well, I think one of the things that really jumps to mind, which is sort of exactly in line with one of the stories that you were sharing with me about, you know, reporting a case to Child Protective Services or whatever your local agency is called, is kind of twofold. I think number one, that there's sort of an understanding out there that that calling in Child Protective Services is like the very last ditch effort, and it should never be done, never be taken lightly. And, you know, there's a certain amount of truth to that. But I think there is also a balance where you can realize that you are the advocate for the child and that this agency and organization is in place to ensure the safety of children, not to take them away from, you know, deserving parents and not to cause unnecessary trauma to families. And then, you know, likewise, the kind of the second piece to that is that I think that there is a belief that when you're dealing with parents, that telling them that you are a mandated reporter or telling them that you're going to be calling Child Protective Services automatically just completely destroys any relationship that you have with parents. But I don't always necessarily believe that to be true. I think it is possible to have an open and trusting relationship with parents, even when you are activating, you know, a secondary response.
Yeah. So I really like both of those. Let's go ahead and break them down individually for just a quick second. So the first one's basically that we truly are the advocates for the patient and that sometimes reaching out, and this will obviously depend on your setting and state institutions, so on, but sometimes you can reach out to, whether that's Children's Division or DFS, CPS, whatever it's called, like you said, but whoever is responsible at the state level for child well-being, that, you know, obviously the kind of classic ones, like this kid's in immediate danger, should not be going home with the parents tonight, is the one that's pretty straightforward, right? We call law enforcement and we call the relevant agency and get things under control. That one's a little more straightforward there. Sometimes it's not so straightforward though. And sometimes what we're doing is I have just a concern, like there's something that's just not clicking here that I don't feel comfortable with. And that obviously is still very important. Most states, from my understanding, if not all states, is that you report on the suspicion. You don't have to have proof. You just have to have suspicion of concern. So to be able to reach out and say, hey, I'm worried about them. I can't quite put my finger on it, but I have something, you know, something in my gut's telling me that something's not right here. That at least keeps the ball rolling and may provide some services or at least some further evaluation down the line. And then the other thing is too, and I've noticed this more, and sometimes I'm doing it just for this purpose, which is why I think that these agencies can play a role in quite a few patients, is I feel like they may need additional support. So whether that's like, I feel like this family doesn't have what they need at home to best take care of this child. I'm not judging them for that. I'm trying to help them by making sure that we can give them the appropriate resources. I think that's one of the big things that people forget about a lot. You're not condemning these kids to have their parents, you know, being separated from their parents. What you're trying to do is you're trying to get them the most appropriate care possible. And sometimes that is getting a state agency involved.
Right, exactly. And I think one of the most important concepts there is that, or things to know really, is that most of these agencies, at least in my experience, operate very much on sort of a family first mentality. So they're very much interested in family preservation. They're very much interested in not disrupting a household. And their goal really is to walk into a situation and ideally mediate it. Whatever needs to be done, whether that is, you know, child, like parent education classes, whether that is supervised visits, whether that's a temporary foster home while everyone kind of gets their regroups and gets their stuff together, or whether that is removing the children from the household. The goal is to both protect the child and to hopefully maintain the family within reason. And so I think that's something that not a lot of people realize or know. They have this vision of kind of them calling, you know, them starting this process and these children being sort of ripped away from the parents and it being very traumatic for everybody involved, when really, like, all you had to go on was just sort of that, you know, healthcare provider, like, spidey sense. Like, you just, like you said, something wasn't quite right. You're not really sure exactly what's wrong. You don't really have like a suspicious fracture or odd bruising pattern or something else that might really lead you down a path of like child abuse. You just don't think that something is quite right. And there's a hesitance to call like the agencies in that case, because I think there's a fear that the children will be just immediately removed. But I have never found that to be the case.
So that ties in really nicely to the second point of what you're bringing up, and that was the actual reporting site, which we're going to talk about a whole lot more later, but I think it's worth just hitting this early because the dogma behind it, and that's because of the relationship side between you and the parents or whoever the caregivers are. I for one, and I'll be happy to talk about this more because I would love to hear your views of this too, but for me, most of the time that I'm going to call, I'm usually not going to give the parents a heads up that we're doing it. Now, some cases, if it's one of those like, okay, something's not quite right here, family already kind of knows that something's not right for whatever concern there is, then we have a very open engagement. I usually explain like, hey, with what's going on here, I think we really need to have someone else get involved. And that may be all I really say. But for the ones where I say, I really don't know what to expect yet, but I'm worried there's something at home, but it's not something where immediate interventions required, where this patient can't be discharged, I may not always tell parents that we're calling that state agency in advance. For the main reason why is because sometimes these parents are maybe the same ones who are going to be wanting to hide something, and you're giving them basically a 2 to 3 day head start in some cases, so they can get rid of whatever you know, and change the environment enough to avoid that. And I understand that maybe, again, depending on someone's perspective, I'm not saying I'm solely right on this. I definitely see times where it's good to get people involved and let them know early, but I think it's very situation dependent. It's the big part of that. But you're right. I don't feel like in all cases you're going to ruin that relationship by letting them know ahead of time, hey, I am calling this agency because I believe that there may be something more. And then that a lot of times we can provide some further help for you all.
Right. And I definitely agree with you on some of those points. It's a 100% situational and case by case basis. And that's one of the things that overall makes these topics difficult to talk about, because, you know, we could go round and round with what if questions till we're blue in the face, but when we still won't really hit every single possibility. So it's definitely situational, but I do believe that it's possible to maintain a trusting relationship with family. I mean, it's a little bit harder when they are the suspected offenders or the known offenders. I think that does get a little bit sticky, and you do want to, as much as possible, allow Child Protective Services the chance to sort of evaluate the situation organically, as opposed to like whatever the parents have done to sort of change the environment to improve it, in other words. But I do think it is a lot easier when the parents are the non-offenders and it's like another family member or a friend or something like that, or an unknown person. So I do agree. It is kind of a case by case situation.
Yeah. And if you can't tell by listening, we're already trying to figure out how detailed do you go on something like this? Because like you said, you can dive into this one subject and you could probably make this a couple hours worth conversation as you try and go through different scenarios and stuff like that. But I think the key part is what you've already mentioned, Katie, and that is there are ways to maintain the relationship here. So don't think that by reporting, you've completely destroyed that.
Yeah, and I do think that is the key point, exactly.
All right, so what else, Katie? What other things are we screwing up that we need to realize we're doing wrong?
Well, I mean, I think just you saying that is kind of one of them. I think that I think this stands for sort of all of interpersonal violence, but I think this is why IPV educators exists at all, is because I think there's this overarching concept, especially with children, but with all populations that experience interpersonal violence, that by touching or interacting or you know, talking to like survivors, that you're somehow going to completely screw it up and cause some sort of irreparable damage or change in what the next like proceeding steps are, or traumatize the individual needlessly, or et cetera, et cetera.
So I actually said that very intentionally because I was hoping you would take that point, because you're right. There's a lot we can do. And I feel like we're not going to screw this up down the line. I think there are some things that we need to talk about specifically, like the forensic interview and when to turn that over to someone who's more qualified / specialized in that role. But there are still things we can do in the history and physical side that we won't mess this up. One thing I want to talk about with the reporting side still that ties in directly with the history and physical is one of the most common things I see as far as dogma. And that's, we already kind of mentioned it, but you have to have proof, right? I mean, you have to have proof that this is going on, and I think is the one that I hear the most. Well, I didn't call because I don't have a way to prove that this child is being abused.
Yeah. So I don't think you have to have proof at all. And I think that is a common sort of misconception that you have to somehow unlock this yourself. But, you know, we as healthcare providers, especially if you're working in acute care or even family, you know what, honestly, I take that back, just about anywhere. I think there's this impression that we are supposed to be these sort of independent bastions for medicine and all things social support, and that we will somehow be able to handle any situation that arises. And it can be really overwhelming to think about like that. So I think one of the biggest points to raise here is that you're not alone out there. Like, you have the resources, to help you kind of decide what the next steps are. You just have to know where those are for your community and how to unlock them. And that's one of the major points that I preach overall when I lecture, is that a little pre-planning goes a long way. So the more you know about how the reporting process works, where your local resources are, and so forth, I think the better prepared you are for when one of these things lands in your emergency room or your clinic or whatever your work environment is.
I like that. And having that, we've talked about before, having some sort of plan ahead of time is obviously going to be much better, and having that pre-plan in place than trying to figure out what you're going to do at that time, because this can be a very time-consuming process too. Not for us to not want to do it, but it is something, the more we have in place ahead of time, the easier this is to do the reporting, to do the evaluation, and so on.
Precisely.
So let's talk a little more about like dogma and history. Are there certain things that you hear about with the history that just makes you cringe, or things that you see with people asking that you're like, we can do this better?
Well, I think especially with children, people are afraid to ask questions of children. They're afraid to engage kids in a conversation about what might or might not have happened. And I think for a variety of reasons, they're afraid that they're going to traumatize the children. They're afraid that they're somehow going to, you know, manipulate or change the way that the child is thinking about what happened, that type of thing. But I think that it's really much easier than people think to learn how to like open that discussion with children and to talk to children like honestly about their bodies and about what might be happening to them and things like that, without going too deep into like a forensic interview and without like manipulating or changing the way that the investigation can proceed.
Speaking of, can I have a quick rant on something here? And that is about like anatomy and teaching our kids anatomy. So I have two girls, and my wife's background, she's one to very much support. Like, she'll be very interested, I'm sure, to listen to these upcoming podcasts because of her background in child services and whatnot. But, you know, one of the things that we have made sure to teach our children is appropriate anatomy. So giving things the appropriate anatomical labels. So not giving a nickname to the vagina, for example, or rectum or stuff like that. You know, we call it what it is. And I know some people may think like you're telling her, you know, 2-year-old what a vagina is. I'm like, yes, that's because she has it. And, you know, she also knows what a penis is too. But for, you know, not only is that good health wise, because let's call things what they actually are, so we don't have these weird nicknames that no one else understands. And then you get in conversations and, you know, I've heard it called all sorts of things, but like front butt is one example. Like, what the hell is that? At least that one I can understand kind of what it means. But when you give it some sort of, you know, nickname, like a flower or something like that, are we talking about a literal flower? Are we talking about the flower that's your vagina? You know, those types of things I feel like are some of the main obstacles that you can run into history-wise, because when you ask a child what happened, especially a child that's old enough to kind of explain things, and they're using colorful language versus, you know, anatomical, it drives me nuts, because it makes it harder to sometimes be able to really understand and really evaluate what's going on.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, I, as a forensic examiner, you know, I happen to work, I have the luxury of working in an environment where I'm doing forensic interviews with the parents first and then the children. And one of the first things that I ask the parents is, I say, like, what do you call the vagina? What do you call the butt? What do you call the penis, like, in your household? Or what do they call it? What does the child call it? And so I have the luxury of kind of going in pre-prepared with that information. But, you know, I think one of the things I would say about talking to children about this and, is that, I mean, you know, you can really go down a rabbit hole with like forensic interviewing technique and how to talk to children about concepts that may be sort of beyond them. But there's a few sort of like very basic, very clean, easy to incorporate into your practice principles that provide like kind of the basics of a solid forensic questioning series without having to do like a complete clean forensic interview, without having to like worry about, you know, delving too deeply into that, but also without, but also like sort of eliminating that fear that you're going to somehow like mess it up for the future.
Okay. So I think in a sense we've covered the history dogma that we can without diving too much in the other stuff, because again, we're going to have those as upcoming podcasts. So don't worry. Don't feel like you've been cheated on this, because I feel like dogma on history is really more about dogma of forensic interviewing. So that ties in now to what kind of dogma on the physical exam side, or talking about the physical findings regarding abuse in children.
This could be a whole 3-hour lecture series on its own, yeah, I think.
So I guess highlights, big ones, the ones that drive you nuts.
Yeah. Well, I think one of them is that many providers that I talk to, because, you know, when I worked for one of the organizations that I used to work for in the Los Angeles area, we also welcomed and took many sort of advice calls from like local ERs or local law enforcement. So I think that was a really nice service for them to have, because they could call in and say, you know, I've got this kid here. I don't really know what's going on. Maybe if I describe it, you can help me decide whether I need you, or whether, like, you know, I can, whether I'm just sort of making this stuff up or thinking about this too deeply or something. So I think I interacted with a lot of sort of ER, family practice, law enforcement, that type of stuff, with just sort of questions. And one of the major ones that comes up is like, sort of, how can I identify abuse? Because I think that there's like, especially with young children who are being abused, there's this sort of like scary nonverbal component, right? Where they may not be very clear about what they're saying, or they might not even be able to speak to you. And so how do you identify it in a physical exam? And there's a lot of sort of pitfalls there, or at least I think providers feel like there's a lot of pitfalls, a lot of things that could be misinterpreted. And unfortunately, one of the things I'm going to say is never very popular when I lecture either, because I say, you know, there's really no there's no absolute certain physical findings besides a few. And those are like the big red flag, you know, like mid-shaft femur fractures in like pre-walking children, or, you know, vaginal lacerations, at certain locations in, you know, prepubescent children, and, you know, things like that. Like, these are things that, you know, you won't have a problem identifying, but it's sort of that middle ground, that gray space that can be very difficult.
I don't think in most cases the fracture itself is going to be defining unless you're running into a few unique populations. Is that fair to say?
I would say so. I think that there are the well-documented and well-published, like you were saying, red flag fractures, so to speak, that are just basically 99% plus associated with abuse. But outside of that, I think that there is a lot of kind of flexibility. And I think that is one of the things that's scariest for providers, is that there's no black and white answer. It's not like you give this dose of medication and only this dose. That flexibility can be frightening for people. This is where that sort of art of medicine comes in. And we practice this all over the place. You know, there's no right or wrong way to counsel a patient to quit tobacco either. You know, I mean, we learn about a few possible ways, but then it's sort of up to us to employ them in a clinic setting in a way that you know, matches our relationship with the patient and hopefully provides the greatest success. And so similar to that, I don't think there's any right, like wrong or right way to approach this sort of like gray area of the physical exam. I do want to talk about generalized erythema in like young girls, like vaginal erythema. And I do think it's sort of important to talk about some of Dr. Adams' work around findings that are like 100% associated with abuse versus somewhat associated versus not associated at all. Another thing that I think that that providers sort of frequently misconstrue is kind of like some in sexual abuse, or in sexual abuse, especially of young girls, there's a lot of gray area surrounding the physical exam and whether providers should even do it. And if so, what are they looking at? And if so, how do they interpret those findings? And so I think that one of the big questions I get a lot from people that are referred to the forensic exams or forensic interviews is sort of like that nonspecific generalized vaginal erythema or redness or irritation, or the child seems to be itching more. And so I think it is it's important to sort of know where your resources are there too. One of the predominant pediatricians or researchers in this area is Dr. Adams, and she's basically devoted her life to the study of pediatric abuse. And she has this wonderful chart that you can find on PubMed, and it basically has like findings that are associated, that are like almost always or always associated with child abuse, child sexual abuse, findings that are like sort of in that gray area, and then findings that are absolutely not associated with abuse, but that are commonly misconstrued as abuse. And so I think that that's a really good resource for clinicians because it gives them an opportunity to sort of like think about the way that they're practicing and what their thought processes are in those areas and how to apply that to like sort of moving forward if you ever have to do an investigation or an interpretation of child abuse.
And we'll have these linked into the show notes as well, which Katie will provide me the references for. So we'll have that graph hopefully on the website for you guys.
Yes, absolutely.
So that's one that I've kind of run into a little bit, and I think again will be something to talk about here more shortly over the coming podcasts is at what point, like, are we doing just an external exam and to what extent and stuff like that. But one last topic, because we're kind of running out of time for this portion, because like you said, we could keep going on. So I'm trying to keep these around a half hour or so. I think another one that's a major dogma is alternative medicine, right? So alternative medicine practices and like signs that can be confusing for abuse and stuff like that. One that I remember specifically from PA school that I was hoping you could talk about a little bit is cupping.
Yes. On a very, very small tangent. Have you ever read The Spirit Catches You and You Fall Down?
I've heard of this book. In fact, I think you recommended it to me, but no, I have not read it.
Well, I mean, I'm kind of in love with this book. I think honestly, it should be required reading in PA school, or before PA school, or at some point, or really just like in every form of medicine, because it actually really changed the way that I think about and approach alternative or cultural differences in medicine. But without going like too far down that rabbit hole, because believe me, I could talk about that book for an hour by itself alone. I think that it's really important to be able to very clearly in your mind draw a distinction between alternative medicine and child abuse. Now, there are some areas that kind of cross over where traditional medicine or treatments that could be life-saving or life-changing for a child are being denied to the child, or medicine and medications are being used as a form of manipulation, in which case like that may cross that line back into abuse. And so there are some exceptions, but I think that it's important to realize that cultural differences in medicine and or like alternative medicine in children is not abuse. In just the way that you might not agree with your patient about like, say, going to a chiropractor or seeing an acupuncturist, whatever your individual opinions are, they aren't actually like hurting themselves by doing so. They are... like maybe they think it works. Maybe it has some sort of effect on their overall positivity in life. And so, you know, who's to say whether it is really like having a positive medicinal effect? But I think it's important to realize that these findings like cupping and coining and even like there's some like light caning and stuff like that that occurs in some different types of religious practices, these are not classified as abuse unless you can identify that the child is traumatized or permanently injured or disfigured from these practices.
No, I think that's a good one to wrap up on, Katie, just because there are going to be variations. And like you said, sometimes even like traditional Western medicine can at times be used in a very manipulative way that can be in its own right abuse, but alternative practices are not necessarily abuse. It's the main thing about what outcomes and how it's affecting the child itself, which I think is a very important key to remember as we're looking at these, because although we may not agree with them, If they are doing things that are not causing direct harm, that might be something to remember. Now, that can sometimes be very much a judgment call, which I think is something you kind of alluded to as well. So it might be one of those where if we're seeing more and more of this, or if we're seeing something that's kind of questionable with this, maybe this is still something that we give a phone call to. But I think that's, again, like everything else related to this, is very situational dependent.
Yeah, indeed. And this is one of the reasons why I recommend this book to everybody, why I recommend The Spirit Catches You to everybody, is because there's actually sort of multiple very clean examples of a lot of these different scenarios in there. There's a whole point where the child that is involved, or the child who is the patient, is being absolutely 100% denied Western medicine, or it's just like they're not even taking her. They're refusing to take her to doctor's appointments. And so like Child Protective Services gets involved and does in fact take the child out of the home for a while in order to like reevaluate the situation and everything. So there's like that clean example. There's another example where they're incorporating alternative practices with Western medicine, albeit it, they might not be 100% succeeding at doing Western medicine the way that we would like them to, the parents, I mean. But still, there's a couple of really good examples in there of where those practices are coexisting like side by side to certain degrees of success. So I do think it's a good like place to start as far as like an exploration into both yourself and you know, society as a whole, as to like how these things can very sort of peacefully and not so peacefully coexist with each other.
Well, thank you, Katie, so much for this. And for those listening, don't worry. We're going to talk a lot more about more subjects with pediatrics. In fact, I think the next one's going to be regarding sexual abuse specifically, which is another topic that we could probably talk for a very long period on. But we're going to focus on some of the highlights in about a, you know, a half hour or so segment. But before we go, Katie, can you go ahead and give us the tagline, please?
Yes. Until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.